Let's hear some of that movie chat. Credits roll by and I tip my hat. Credits roll by, wanna know more right away. Let's have some of that movie chat. Credits roll by, tell me who did that. Life in the credits is where I wanna play.
Welcome to Life in the Credits. This is the show where we learn about entertainment by chatting with people who work in the industry. I'm Susan.
And I'm Ben. And today we're discussing the film Close.
And joining us today is our special guest, Satchu Mahava. So welcome, Satchu. Thank you for joining us.
Hey there.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited you're on the show.
We're very excited. So, Satchu, can you get us started today by telling us a little bit about what you do in the entertainment world?
Well, I actually do quite many things, but some part of my time is fixing things for crews coming outside of Finland. So I work as a fixer, but in addition to that, I produce independent feature films, but also documentary films. And then I've started to direct my own independent documentary films as well. So pretty much everything what kind of comes in.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So what does a fixer do?
Well, I kind of would describe it as your local tour guide. So basically when a film crew wants to come shoot something, whatever it is in Finland, I'm helping them to get adjusted to the Finnish way of making things, finding them contacts, finding them places to shoot, making realistic plans for the shooting, getting the paperwork done, whatever they need for their shoot. So I would say it's almost like a travel guide job in the beginning. For example, if you're doing scouting or recce, it's like just going around and enjoying places, finding things to do. And it's just, it's quite a lot of fun, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Very cool. Can you tell us about any of the specific projects you've been a fixer on or some of the shows?
Yeah, I've done quite a few. The most previous ones were the Somebody Feed Phil episode in Helsinki. That was fantastic. Then I've done Building Impossible for National Geographic. That was about the biggest cruise ship built ever in the world.
Yeah.
Wow.
Australian travel guys, Rob and Romes for the UK television, and many, many European series, Chinese series, whatever, pretty much you name it. Yeah. Very kind of from all over the globe, pretty much.
Very cool. So before we get too far into the details of what you're currently doing, can you give us your background for this career? Like what education, any experiences you had that led you to where you're at in your career today?
Let's say when I was younger, I was really keen on theater. So I was interested on writing and performing. But then I kind of, when I was looking for options to go to uni, I was like, history maybe, I don't know what I was thinking. But then I applied as a secondary option to study communication and TV and screenwriting. And that's where I ended up. And that was probably the best disappointment that I had, that I didn't actually get to study history, which sounds quite boring, to be honest. So, so then I ended up studying film and TV, and I did my bachelor degree on that. And kind of in the middle of university, I already started working for several companies, and kind of one thing led to another. And
yeah,
here I am. It's like, you know, quite of a, I would say, normal story on just like getting it started and then having another contact. And then you kind of, 2 years ago, I calculated I've done more than 100 projects.
Yeah, that's wild. So how do you, as someone who kind of represents your whole country, how do you sort of understand everything your country has to offer so that you can show it to other people?
It's kind of easy to answer because I've been living all around the country. So
there you go.
That gives me some sort of a privilege on I know many, many good places. And also I've been shooting in most of the country, pretty much from the southernmost point all the way to the northernmost top. But the thing is that I'm like the if I have to kind of say something about Finland, I have three words and all of them is Lapland. So it's Lapland, Lapland, Lapland. So that's the best place to be and best place to shoot. So that's like, and I was actually, I'm from there originally. So that's like my home turf. Now I couldn't actually live there anymore because it's too small and too cold, but I love to go there on a shoot and enjoy time with people coming from outside of Finland. It's just spectacular. It's really something.
Nice.
Excellent.
Interesting part is that the weather, because it's so challenging, really important, especially in the winter time. It's really important part of our prep, and it can start from giving information how to prepare yourself for the finish, whether that is minus 40 Celsius. It can be how to prepare cameras, how to prepare everything for a smooth shoot. And that's something that you wouldn't necessarily kind of have to deal with the Mexican fixer, but
a little bit different.
Yeah, way more like climate challenges. So do they use equipment that they get there, or are they bringing all their own stuff and you're just helping them like weatherize it pretty much?
Yeah, it actually depends, but the cameras are funny in that way that they really are not afraid of cold.
Oh, yeah.
So there are crews that want to put winter jackets on cameras, but as a local, I would never put anything on the camera because the only thing that is afraid of cold is the battery. So basically, we are always preparing if you're going out shoot on a cold weather. We have this battery case that is heated inside. Okay. So it's basically reversed fridge box for the batteries. Yeah. So that's pretty much the only thing you have to worry about when it comes to equipment. But that's actually very difficult on some people to even comprehend, because that's like you just have to climatize the camera. And it's when you're going out to the cold weather, it's actually no problem. But when you're coming to the in, if you're moving from exterior to interior, then you have a problem because everything fogs up. So for that, you have to arrange special time, or you have to have a second camera or stuff like that is really important to take account, because that can delay the shoot for 1 hour because you can't really heat up the camera.
Yeah.
So that's one of those like really precise details that show that how important it is to have local people working with. Because that's the things that you really don't know beforehand if you have never worked in cold circumstances.
So how do you get involved with these different international shows? Do you just get there through word of mouth or through connections? Do you have an agent you work with, or do their agents reach out to you? How do you get those jobs with companies from like China, the US, you know, all over the world?
90% probably are coming just by through people I know, like word of mouth, then Facebook and other platforms. Yeah. No, I haven't actually ever worked with the agent or manager. So everything is coming just through different channels, and it's quite of a strange flex sometimes. You can see somebody asking for Facebook, does anyone know anyone from Finland? And it's really, really shady and unclear, and who is writing or who is asking. But I usually, I'm quite open-minded. I like to get to know people, so I write them, okay, well, you can reach out to me. And usually it's even the person who is looking for, who is asking that question. And then there's like, okay, I'm going to tell my friend, who is going to tell to a friend, and who's going to tell to a friend. And then somebody emails me, and we take it from there. So it's quite funny.
It's wild that because we've talked to another fixer before who said something very similar. And so it's wild that a whole industry works that way.
Yeah, it's really interesting though. And it makes sense because, I mean, it's not like there's going to be, you know, like, oh, here's who you talk to if you go to Finland. There's this one person. Here's who you talk to if you go to Mexico City. Here's this, you know, one person. So it makes sense that it's word of mouth. And just, I mean, the whole point of a fixer is that you know the country and you know you can tell them where to go. So it makes sense you'd have the through word of mouth get that connection to the show. Yeah.
Right. And I'm sure, you know, with each country having its own laws and rules around shooting and all these other things, someone who's local, who not only knows the area, but also knows like the paperwork and all like the logistics, I would imagine invaluable.
So do you deal with that part of it too then? Like making sure that they're right, like they're following the rules, you know, guidelines and stuff?
Yeah, everything. So basically, the most services I provide are from the airport to the time of departure. So everything that they need, from food to permits to anything. But I think Finland is one of the best countries. I've shot with fixers from also outside of Finland. So I've been a client for myself. And I think that also gives me a kind of a good firsthand information. So what people actually want from a fixer, and it gives a good kind of idea on how to, if you want to develop the business and how to take it. So I would say Finland is one of the best countries to shoot because the permits are so easy to get. You can do pretty much anything. So that's always the surprise that comes from most of the crews, is that if they ask that, okay, is this possible tomorrow? I'm like, yes, just bring the camera and let's do it. And it's just like, they're always like, okay, but do you need time for permit, or do you need to blah, blah, this or that? And I'm just like, no, let's just do it. And it's really, at it's just the best.
That's awesome.
That's quite different than it is here in America, yes. That's wild. So, you know, I know you work on your own projects as well, Satya. So does working as a fixer ever help you, you know, learn things that you can actually take back to your projects?
Definitely. I would say that, like, working with, for example, the crew from Somebody Feed Phil, that was one of the best teams I've ever seen working with each other. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, you know, because there are projects that are quite chaotic. And I think every project in their way is chaotic. But, you know, when you see crews that have been working for a long, long time together, you just kind of, it's quite seamless and it's nice to watch. And of course, from that, you can take like, okay, this is something I can take for myself and my own project. And of course, then if there's a chaotic project, you can see that, okay, that I definitely don't want to do that.
Yeah, you learn from the good
and
the
bad ones. Great example of what not to do. So when a show like Somebody Feed Phil comes in, have they already researched a lot of what they want to shoot, or like restaurants they want to visit or regions they want to visit? Or do they come to you and be like, what would you recommend is the best way to show Finland through the food?
It completely depends. So in Phil, I think we did quite a lot of research and also used my contacts, and I was reaching out to people, but they definitely had some bullet points that these we definitely want to see, and can you please figure it out for us? And it's just like, completely depends on the crew, and sometimes it's just like, okay, we have everything settled, we just need a ride and we just need some food and some, so it's like, and it can also be that, only, you know, the people come with, we only have this idea, can you find us people, can you find us locations, can you arrange everything?
Yeah, that makes sense.
What's the craziest thing that they've actually ever had you help with?
All my clients, I try to treat with special love, that I don't think that anything is crazy, because that's how you keep your clients happy. So it's like, it's very different, because I'm working with local crews as well and with local directors. Yeah. And I think it's very different how it's like to fix the services I've made up, because you are kind of serving the client who comes and tries to. So you have to be realistic on what is happening. But I've had requests like having a Ferris wheel on the biggest market square in the Helsinki in 2 days. So obviously not maybe possible, but give me 1.5 weeks and I can make that happen. But it's always like, you know, with clients, they can have many sort of ideas on what they want. And then you just have to be very gentle with giving the bad news, what is possible, what is not. But of course, when you think about Finland, I can't even count how many times I've get this request, let's say in July, that, okay, we want to shoot something where we have 50 centimeters of snow. And I'm like, in Lapland, there is currently midnight sun. So sun is throughout the day.
Yeah.
There is no snow. So that's... Right.
They forget that you still have seasons. It doesn't always look like a Christmas card. Even though I'm sure it's very pretty all the time, but...
Yeah, Finland is known for that, you know, that climate. I mean, I believe a lot of holiday movies are actually shot there, right?
Yeah, quite few, and especially Christmas films and that are kind of revolving the Santa Claus and reindeers. Yeah. And also in the recent years, there has been quite few that has been shot, but also like action movies and US indie films, and it's kind of spreading, and it's nice to see something else besides the Christmas view as well. I quite like doing the Christmas episodes, because the locations are always the same. I don't really know how many times I've been in Santa Claus Village, but basically for me it's like a dream, because I know everybody, I know where everything is. So last time I was there was a crew member who wanted to have an ironing board in the Santa's village, and I knew where to find it, and it was from the Santa's post office. So, you know, it's these small things, but of course it's nice to do something fresh and new, and sometimes it's very fun to do something that you've done 15 times and trying to figure out something new that you can provide and give.
It keeps you flexing those creative muscles, even if it's an environment you know really well. So also have your whole own film career outside of being a fixer. I know you have done a lot of documentaries. You talked about you're moving into directing. So how did that facet of your career start out?
Oh, I started with the production management and, okay. and producing, and the fix being a fixer is more like a side gig okay. that I've been doing. So it's not like a full-time job. So it's more like a side, but a very nice side job, I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I started doing documentaries on themes and subjects that I found like ideologically important for me. And then it's kind of developed into a career, and that's it's kind of a very I think my career is pretty much like that, one thing led to another, and
yeah,
and there are like hundreds of these things, and yeah.
What are some of the topics that you've covered that have been important to you?
Well, the most recent feature film actually was released just this year, and it was premiering in Tribeca and also in Toronto International. So it's called Jevida, and it's about this indigenous community that is in Finland that is really neglected in the times of in our like very recent history. So telling a story like that it's how can I say, normal people sharing their life stories in different parts of the world or in Finland, but something that is not maybe it's not the story of David Beckham, but it can be somehow very important story to share. So that's something that is very, very like key interest for me. But human interest and just normal people telling their life stories, that's something that has always intrigued me.
Do you like being able to show like a fuller picture of Finland through your documentaries?
Yeah, sometimes the documentary film I'm co-directing right now and producing, it is about the Ukrainian doctor who has lived in Finland for 1.5 years. So she's like a, I wouldn't say refugee, but something like that. She has moved to Finland. Then she's trying to find her way of being in this society and in this time of war, and how she can like help people and help the fellow Ukrainians who are in trying to start their lives in Finland, what is difficult from them, and kind of a very normal but not something that you would necessarily at first connect with mm-hmm. Finland. But of course it depends totally on the subject, that yeah. what is the like the thing that we're looking at and kind of exploring. Yeah
that's definitely great.
Well, congratulations on your film getting into those
pieces.
That's
really
festivals.
Exciting.
Yeah, I've been quite lucky because I've got the chance to work with some of the best directors in Finland, the most prominent, and it's just like I've been really lucky to being able to work with those people, and of course that's the fruitful part of it, that you can benefit into something and you can be around the best people who can make those films that can reach festivals, audiences, and create maybe some difference in the world.
Yeah.
Is the Finland film community, is it a big community or is it pretty tight-knit?
Quite tight, I would say.
Oh, okay. Great. When you're shooting documentaries, what style do you use? Do you do a lot of pre-planning where you kind of know what you're going to capture, or do you go out there and just sort of, you know, capture everything and then figure out your story in post?
Oh yeah, that there's the other end and there's the other end. So basically I've done both. So
yeah,
I'm pretty all over there. Like you can start from scratch. For example, the documentary we're working on now, we had no idea what we were doing, and my co-director, I wasn't actually going because we just had the idea that we want to, there were these crazy bus trips that were going to the border of Poland and Ukraine, and they wanted to take as many Ukrainians to Finland as possible. So they were driving there with these big buses and taking people back. So we just thought that, okay, this is something that is quite fascinating in some way. And we had no idea who will be there. We had no idea what's going to happen. So it was question mark. But then we found out our protagonist, and it kind of started to live its own life from there. But sometimes in some projects, it's very precise. I was working as a production manager 2 years ago for this HBO documentary series, but it was about the prime minister and other four ministers working in the Finnish parliament at the time. And it was very special because they were all, or four of them were on their 30s and females. So it was very special time in the Finnish history and maybe even the world history. So, but it, when working with those ministers, it was like, it's really precise. You can get like 40 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever. So you have to plan. You have to be really precise and take the most out of the time that they have. And also we shot for somebody Feed Phil. We were working together with the ex-prime minister, Sanna Marin, and also there. We had really specific schedule. No like chances on being a flexible or changing anything. It's the slot you got and you have to make it work.
Yeah, definitely.
I think with these films that you kind of give so much out of your, you kind of donate so much of your time.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, when you grow older, you just want to make the most out of your time, of course. So you get kind of a bit pickier what you choose. And and if it's not something like, because what I really love about being a fixer is that it's a very short amount of time, but it's not maybe the most important job of showing, you know, the Northern Lights of Finland to whoever or whatever we are doing, but it's just fun. It's just good fun. And, you know, you can enjoy and you can be in the nature and you can get to know, you know, good people all around the world. So it's always like a question of what has it to offer you pretty much.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I will say with travel shows, especially like food related ones, they do. I mean, like Somebody Feed Phil is a huge show in the US. So there's probably a lot of people who may not know a lot about the countries he's visiting. And now they get to learn about it through this show, you know, in a really easy to process format. So I think there is still a lot of like meaning, like they have a really powerful impact. Yeah. Even if, I mean, even just seeing the Northern Lights, you know, there's people who may never get to go see them in person and now they get to have this experience. So I think it's really cool. Yeah.
And I think it's like, for me as a Finnish, I'm especially Lapland is kind of just a really personal reason to be proud of my country. So it's always when we go, it's just like so fantastic to show people around and just enjoy and seeing them like being all stunned about the nature. It's just like, it's so much fun.
Yeah, you get to show off the parts you really want people to see and, you know, understand. I think it's really powerful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Satu, as a fixer, as a producer, as a director, what's the most challenging part of your job?
Oh, that's a good question. I think like if we're talking on a broad perspective, it's the time management and like this current issue on balancing between work and free time and what's the limit between that and how much you can kind of give from yourself to the work or the job you are doing. Mm-hmm. But once you get that sorted out, I've always been like, I have one kind of a key idea that I've been trying to, especially in fixer world, is that something is asked from me or if there's a request, I always try not to say no first, because saying no is so easy. So I kind of try to take it in and I try to find a solution. If this is actually possible, that I don't need to know why they want to have this. I don't need to know why, but I just try to think, okay, can I arrange this? And you know, most of the times when you kind of go beyond the why, that why you don't actually maybe want to do it, you can find out that, okay, I can do it. This is not actually even difficult to do, but I just was like very, how can I say, I didn't want to actually do it. So it was, I thought it was stupid or whatever. So I think that's also like, has been one of the kind of a key points on making people enjoy and really appreciate my services, on always trying to kind of take any request as that, okay, it might be possible. And if it's possible, then I will make it happen. So that's like a quite important attitude for myself. And that has helped me in many ways during the years.
That's great.
Is there anything about Finland you discovered by helping people make connections for filming that maybe it's something you didn't really know about?
Yeah, definitely. Like I think in every, like if we think about Somebody Feed Phil, it's just opened up a total, like, I love eating out and I'm really like, I know most of the restaurants in Helsinki, but it still opened up something new for me. So it's always like meeting new people. I think that's the real richness of doing this work, is that you get to be around, if there are the crew members coming from outside of Finland, that's fantastic, but also the Finnish people that you kind of get to introduce, because there are many, like, for example, the Building Impossible that was shot in the one of the biggest ferry harbors. I don't know. The place where they build ships, basically.
Yeah, that works.
Shipyard, I guess.
So basically, if it wouldn't be for the filming, I would have never been in the in that shipyard and seeing that huge ship and seeing all these like big moves of different things on the ship. And it's just like, it's very fascinating where you get to go and who you get to meet. And that's definitely best part of it. But it's very important to always keep an open mind that if you've been somewhere for 20 times, you can still go for the 21st time and find out something new or fascinating.
Very cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. So do you have any moments from any part of your career that's either just a favorite moment or a moment where you're like, I can't believe this is what I get to do for a living?
Well, I have quite of a down-to-earth perspective on this. I've been lucky enough to travel to many, many countries, and that's definitely, I would say, salt in the job that you get to travel and see places, meet people. But I would say that the real... what has kept me on doing what I'm doing is the people who I'm working with, the key people that I have in my crew, and having fun with those guys. And, you know, it's not easy sometimes, but still, when you have those people around you, you can find some laughter in very difficult and challenging moments of crisis, but still it's like you came out of together. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, the people who you're working with, and kind of building from that and enjoying their company and enjoying their time. And that's kind of, for me, what I always remember from different shoots, is the people who I've worked at that time. And with some I've worked over 10 years with.
Yeah.
It's always a blast. So I would say that's like my kind of that I get to work. Yeah. Some of them have become my friends, and some are not necessarily friends, but really good work colleagues. So it's definitely, that's definitely the best part of it.
Yeah, I think that's great. This is a tough industry. It's a lot of hours. So knowing that you get to work with people you like every day is huge. It's a huge part of it. It makes it, you know, way more enjoyable. So.
Well, Satu, we got one more question for you before we move on and talk about the movie. That question is, what advice do you have for people who are looking to get into the industry, whether it's directing, producing, being a fixer, or just general advice? What would you tell the folks like that?
Have some trust on what you're doing, and just when you have an opportunity, take it, and then you will have next one coming. And just trust on doing what you can and in the best way possible in each moment, and just... that will probably create something new, and then just kind of following that road. So for me, that has worked. And of course, everyone has their own story, but I would say open mind helps a lot of things to start getting along, and kind of being truthful on what you want to do and in what point. So that's the kind of only good advice I can give.
Well, let's get to our featured film. They're discussing the 2022 drama Close. It's written by Lucas Don't and Angelo Tassens, and was directed by Lucas Don't. It stars Eden Damron, Gustav DeWale, and Emily DeCan, who is nominated for an Oscar for Best International Featured Film. So, Susan, here's a quick breakdown. What's this movie about?
Yeah, so this movie follows two really, really best friends, Leo and Remy. They're 13 years old. It's kind of a coming of age tale, but they have this unbreakable, seemingly, friendship. They're so close. They're pretty much brothers. Even Remy's mom calls Leo, I think, a son of her heart, like a term for, like, not my son, but like son of my heart. Just shows how close these two are. And they start grade school, and immediately they're so close, and they're so physically close. They show a lot of physical affection toward each other. Their other students at school start asking them a lot of questions, like, are they in a relationship together? Are they dating? And this makes Leo really uncomfortable, and he starts to pull away from Remy because he gets worried about what the other students are saying about him. And Remy, understandably, is very upset by this. They grow apart, and then very tragically, this movie, if you haven't watched it and you don't want a spoiler, maybe pause it. But
spoiler for sure.
Remy ends up committing suicide, and Leo is obviously has a hard time with this. Everyone has a hard time with it. And it just shows the fallout from that and how Leo processes it, how he, you know, interacts with Remy's family, especially Remy's mom afterwards, and just really shows kind of the consequences of all the events that happened. It also shows Leo's relationship with his family and how that changes too, especially his brother. But really powerful film. Also visually very beautiful. They have a flower farm, Leo's family does, and there's a lot of visuals, a lot of scenes that take place in that, and the visuals are really, really just incredible too. And just the scenery they show in general, the environment. Sasha, you picked this movie. So why did you pick this movie for the episode today?
I think it's just a beautiful story. And for me, it was, you know, you only have few films in your lifetime mm-hmm. that you kind of are somehow collected in your heart. And that yeah. happened for me with that film. So I just think it was spectacularly beautiful. And that's the only reason pretty yeah. much.
Yeah, it is an incredibly well-made film. The acting's amazing. There are times when I'm watching the school scenes where it feels almost like a documentary.
Yes.
Just watching the students interact seems so natural. It definitely doesn't feel very like overproduced or anything. Also, this movie won a ton of awards. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Cannes. You know, obviously it was nominated for an Oscar. Really critically acclaimed film as well.
So, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, obviously this is a heartbreaking film. Yeah. It's about the suicide of a 13-year-old boy, but it's also just, like you said, a beautiful film. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of heart in the movie. And it's also just extremely well made. The visuals are, they really add to the story. And it's fascinating because watching it, I was really drawn to how often the film is just Leo's reaction to everything. It stays on a pretty close-up shot of his face for a lot of the movie. It's just him reacting to everything he hears and learns and really absorb him as a character. And the acting for a 13-year-old, I'm not sure how old the actor was when they made this, but he's phenomenal. Like, just everybody in this film is so good. And just watching him go through this, you know, point in his life is just fascinating to watch.
I was reading about the movie, and I guess the director discovered Eden on a train, and he could like see Eden reacting to something, but he couldn't hear him. But just based on those like facial expressions and reactions, he's like, that's the kid I want for this film. Yeah. So, I mean, what you just said about all the close-ups of his face and everything makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
When you figure out why he thought he was the good person for that part in the first place.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the film does a great job with foreshadowing. Like when Leo and Remy first get to school, there's that nice crowd shot and like slowly zooms out and you see all the kids. And as they're like walking around and like really taking it all in. And as they first get there, two girls walk up and walk right in between them and they have to like split up and then come back together. Just a nice visual of how like they have to push apart a little bit, quite literally. And then later on, you know, after the big fight, of course, right after they have this huge pushing match at school, it cuts to the farm, and of course the equipment is chopping up all the flowers. You know, it's those kind of visual cues that really help tell the story, and it's well edited, it's well directed. It's just a really beautiful film all the way through. It's produced by A24, which is of course known
for
making really high quality films. And this one really knocks out of the park. I've never seen it before, so Satu, thank you for recommending it.
I think we don't have enough films about friendships and when friendships come to an end. So, you know, heartbreak, when you break up from a, you know, relationship, it's something that you have some sort of information or you can get support easily to that. Yeah. And you kind of know what you should feel, how you should feel, what you have coming. But what happens if you know, you lose your best friend? And that's something that I think many of us are not really prepared. So it's really like interesting subject. And I think that what kind of intrigued me in this is that it's very small story in a way, but it becomes really universal. And I would say anyone should be able to relate to that in some way. Of course, it's very tragical. So that's the kind of what makes it a film in a way, that of course it has, you know, it has to grow in order to move mountains, but like the pain I think that the both of the boys are experiencing is something that is really universal and can touch, you know, it's not a question of gender or age or anything, right. But it's like very relevant, I would say, and like turn, like when you are not a child anymore and you kind of are, the feelings kind of grow you up in a little bit, and it's just it was, no, I just enjoyed the story, and I think it had like it just felt real, which is always in the when you're forgetting that you're watching a film, that's the best thing that the film can actually achieve.
Yeah, I also loved how that flower farm that followed it through the film, I mean, it began and ended, bookended with the field full of blooms running through it, and I thought that was really powerful. Beginning of the two of them running through the flower field, and then at the end, him running through it by himself and looking back, and then the screen just cuts to black. I really loved the way they shaped the whole narrative with that, you know, that scenery throughout and just following the cycle of the flowers growing, being harvested. You know, they're taking the blooms off, they're tilling the field, they're planting. I mean, it just shows kind of like the whole, follows his whole cycle of growing up and dealing with the death of his friend, you know, through that metaphor, I think is really, was really powerful.
Very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These characters are so relatable, right? Because mm-hmm. so many people have grown up and, you know, as exactly what you're saying, Satu, as they're transitioning from children to being adults, you know, the friendships change, right? People change. And so I think a lot of people can relate. I certainly can relate to, like, you know, having a different friends group between schools and between, you know, as you meet new people and things changing. And so, you know, understanding that. And then, of course, that loss, right, is so powerful. That's certainly something that a lot of people can relate to. And, you know, how a kid deals with that. And I thought the scenes between him and Remy's mother is so powerful, because this is someone that looked at him as a son. And then all of a sudden, you know, with that loss, their relationship could not be more different. Right. And so, but I thought the movie was so good at, like, them, like, watching each other and, like, looking at each other, but not saying anything. Right. So you don't know what's going to happen. But personally, I thought my favorite scene was when, you know, Leo and she are in the car, and, you know, she's giving him a ride home from hockey practice, and he finally admits, you know, I think this is my fault. And she kicks him out of the car, but then they had, like, chase each other through the woods and finally, like, confront each other. I was like, oh my, that's what the moment I wanted in the film, because it's been building for so long of, you know, him really, you know, coming to terms with it himself and finally admitting that he was a part of that, what happened. But also, like, seeing her reaction to it was so powerful. I thought it was beautifully done. And this movie doesn't say more than it needs to. It's not a wordy film.
No, it's really quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it really makes you sit in it, right?
Yeah.
Did you have a favorite scene?
I liked the beginning when they were still tight and the flowers were kind of blooming, and there was this idea of they would last forever. But of course, you know, it's not going to last forever, but you have to cherish the moment that it lasts. And then it's like, I think it does fantastically that it doesn't say a word, but still you can feel the guilt and you can feel all the things that are not said. And it just builds upon that feeling. And it's just, like, remarkable with that.
Yeah.
You have a favorite scene, Susan?
I don't know. There's a lot of really powerful ones. The scene where they're coming home from the field trip and, and they're like, everyone get off your bus, your parents are here. I thought the way that actor handled, I mean, this is a kid acting in this movie, and the way he handled that scene, I think, was really incredible. Just, I mean, he didn't have a huge reaction, but just you saw it on his face and in his eyes so well that he was like, he knew what it was somehow without even being told. So I thought that was a really good one. I mean, the acting of the kids in this movie is really impressive, because this is really serious subject matter, and they handled it so well. And it always felt so honest, which I think, you know, it's hard to do, especially when you're, like, you know, a teenager and maybe you don't have a lot of acting experience. So, yeah.
Well, folks, if you're in the mood for a heavy but beautiful movie,
it is heavy, but it's very good.
Check out Close.
Yeah, yeah.
Us Finnish, we're a bit melancholic, so that's okay. I apologize.
We'd like to finish up our show today with a game that we're calling Mad Props. There's a large market for selling movie props, and we're going to see how well both of you can guess the prices that famous props have sold for. So, Satu, you're going to be playing against Susan. So here are the rules. I'm going to describe a famous movie prop, and you will take turns guessing the price it sold for. Whoever is closest in price will get a point. I have 7 props for you to price, and the person with the most points at the end will win our prize. And Susan, what's our prize?
Some Life in the Credits merchandise.
Yeah.
Or mug, something like that.
All right. Are you ready to play? Fantastic. Susan, are you ready?
Let's go.
All right. Number one. How much did Chris Pratt's Guardians of the Galaxy helmet sell for at auction? And Susan, I'm going to make you guess first on this one.
His helmet.
The helmet from Guardians of the Galaxy. Star-Lord's helmet.
$100,000.
$100,000. And Satu, what's your guess?
$72,000.
Susan gets a point.
Oh.
Correct answer is $160,000.
Whoa. I really thought you were going to be closer, because... That's an insane amount of money.
That's an insane amount of money.
Bought that.
I do not have that information. All right. Number two, by the way, just hint, these are all insane.
Yeah, because there's probably a bunch of versions. Like, he probably had more than one of those helmets for his costume.
I mean, props, they always make more than one of everything, right? Number two, the axe from The Shining. So the famous axe that destroys the bathroom door in The Shining. Satu, you're going to guess first this time. How much do you think that sold for at auction?
Well, that must be expensive if it sold like in the recent years. So I would say
250k. 250, okay, Susan?
I went too low last time, so I'll try. It can't be $500,000. It can't be that, but that's what I'm going to guess.
Okay, well, Satu gets a point.
Okay.
You are actually not too far off. The correct answer is $175,000. So, 1-1.
Wait, how much did the Guardians of the Galaxy helmet sell for?
160.
The axe from The Shining was only that much more, because that's like... way more. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I won't comment on every single one of
these. There's no way to justify these prices. Don't try, Susan.
Yeah, they're all crazy expensive. But
all right, number three. Prince's Purple Rain costume.
Oh.
So his costume from the film Purple Rain, how much did that sell for at auction, Susan?
This has to be a lot. This one I'll guess 500,000.
500,000.
Yeah.
And Satu?
400,000.
You get a point. The correct answer is $192,000.
That's it?
That's still more than the axe.
Yeah, I know, but that's...
I still think $192,000
is a lot. It's a lot. It is. It's just now that the prices in my mind are all skewed because I've been listening to such high numbers now that
All right, well, Satu is taking the lead 2 points to one. All right, number four. Satu, you're guessing first this time. This one's for Gandalf's staff from Lord of the Rings. How much did Gandalf's staff sell for?
Well, 400K.
400K.
That's a good guess. I've been going way too high, so I'm going to guess 100,000.
100,000. Satu gets a third point.
Oh my God.
And you were so close. So you guessed 400. The actual price was $390,000. You were so close.
Nice job.
All right. If Satu gets one more point, she wins.
Oh, this game.
It's getting serious now.
It is serious
now. We have
now.
three more things to look at. All right. And Susan, you have to guess first on this
one.
Indiana Jones's hat from Raiders of the Lost Ark. How much did Indy's hat sell for at auction?
I'm going to guess $300,000.
$300,000. Satu?
I'm gonna go low on this. So 50K.
The actual answer is $500,000. $500,000 for Indiana Jones's hat.
For one of his hats, because he definitely had more than one.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Wow.
All right, you get another point. Number six. All right, we have two left.
Okay.
Getting close. How much did the Back to the Future DeLorean sell for?
400,000.
400,000. Susan?
It's really tough. Only because it's a whole car and people paid $500,000 for a hat. I'm going to guess 1 million.
Satu gets the point. Actual price is $541,200.
Wow.
Yep. So just over $500,000 for the Back to the Future DeLorean. However, so Satu has won the game.
Oh, congratulations.
So well done. We have one more, and we're going to do it just for fun.
Okay.
So the last item up for bid that you guys have to guess, and Susan, you're going to start this one.
Okay.
It's the Wizard of Oz Cowardly Lion costume.
Oh.
The lion, the Cowardly Lion from the Wizard of Oz. How much did that costume sell for?
I'm going to go low on this only because there's like... pieces from that, like the ruby slippers, probably went for like a way more. Oh, yeah. I'm gonna guess $50,000.
$50,000.
Half a million. Satu gets one more point. The actual thing it sold for is $3,077,000.
What?
Oh my.
$3 million
for the Cowardly Lion costume.
Wow, I underestimated the income bracket of Wizard of Oz fans.
Yeah, actually, it sold more for more than the ruby shoes from
Dorothy's. Yeah. I would not expect that.
Isn't that wild? All right, well, Satu, congratulations on winning that game.
Fantastic. I'm going to have a big celebration tonight.
Yeah, great.
Glad to hear.
We will make sure to mail you your prize.
Absolutely.
Before we go, do you have anything you want to plug?
And if somebody doesn't, they can find me on Instagram, Satu Majava, my name. So reach out and stay safe.
Awesome.
Perfect. Well, Satu, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, this was really fun.
The pleasure was all mine. Thanks.
Life in the Credits is hosted and produced by me, Susan Swarner.
And me, Ben Bloom.
It's executive produced by Michelle Levin.
The music is written and performed by Steve Trowbridge. You can hear more of Steve's music at trowbridgesounds.com.
The show logo is created by Melissa Durkin.
If you'd like to support Life in the Credits and get access to exclusive perks, you can do so at patreon.com.
If you'd like to follow or get a hold of us, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Life in the Credits, or shoot us an email at lifeinthecredits@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Wow, I underestimated the income bracket of Wizard of Oz fans.